Today's episode of The Oil Can is brought to you by Remarkably Remote, a new daily microcast from the experts at GoToMeeting, all about making work from home for you with indispensable intel on how to stay sane, motivated, and productive at home. We're here to help you in this brave new remote working world. Find us on smart speakers or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. You can listen to gotomeeting.com/tips. That's gotomeeting.com/tips. Podcast. It's Alan Mitchell along with Jonathan Willis. A very eventful show to come. First, though, we want to say hello to Mr. Excitement up there in the north, John Willis. How are you, sir?
Doing really well, Al. How are you?
I know you've got the entire broadcast community across hockey in North America on their heels or on their toes, depending upon what was written about them. But good to see you on the show today. And have you been busy taking phone calls from various media across North America the last 24 to 48 hours?
Yeah, well, it's funny you say on their toes, because I think you're right. I have them on their toes. They're reaching for a rock and they're about to bring it down. So the reaction's actually been really positive. I've been very pleasantly surprised by the response to the piece.
Well, you know, I was going to say, I think that it was, obviously it was listener reviews and comments, and I thought that you know, it wasn't like you used a velvet glove, but you certainly were not out there, you know, delivering haymakers. It's just a fascinating subject, and what it really told me is what I've always believed about any broadcast, radio or television. The reaction of the listener is very personal. So there's a love or a not love relationship. And a lot of markets are, I would say, very traditional, like Detroit. Some are like, say, Carolina or Tampa Bay, very up modern and hip to what's going on. And I think you find what you are comfortable with as a viewer. When you read all of those pieces and the stuff that you included in terms of what the reaction was, did you get a feeling from the national scale that that's how some broadcasts were perceived, as maybe I'm stepping back 20 years or this is cutting edge?
Oh, certainly. And you know what? I don't know that there's a stylistic choice that's really right or wrong. I think you can be, and this is coming from me, I'm a guy who's always been a big numbers person. I think you can have a very successful modern broadcast without getting into the stats at all, or barely at all. You know, if you've got somebody who's insightful on play-by-play, somebody who's really good at breaking down the game, I know I eat that up. I know a lot of our viewers do. You can do it a bunch of different ways. I think the trick, play-by-play is a very difficult job. And then for the color commentary, trying to analyze things in-game, it's a difficult thing to do. I think anybody who's listened to me try to ad-lib answers to your questions on this podcast realizes that I'd get eaten alive in that role. But, there's a lot of people out there who are very good at adding that insight in-game. And whatever that insight is, people value it, as long as you're giving them something that they don't necessarily recognize themselves when they first watch the play.
And I think that we have examples here in Edmonton that the relationship between the play-by-play guy and the color guy is really important. And sometimes it's not even saying anything for the color guy. It might be not saying anything until there's an appropriate time. And I think you mentioned that in the piece about John Garrett. I believe you did. That he has a tendency to wait until he feels like there's an opening to really express, if it's a thorough thought that's going to take more than 5 seconds, he'll wait for the opportunity.
See, now you're putting me in real danger, because here I am doing an Edmonton podcast saying nice things about John Garrett, which you know, based on the survey results from Edmonton, you don't want to be in. But yeah, when I watch Sportsnet, and this was something that a lot of the survey respondents pointed out, Sportsnet's Vancouver coverage, it's got pauses. There are places where all you hear is the players on the ice, and it's not all the time, but they're well chosen. Garrett, I think, has been in the role long enough that he's comfortable stepping back and not talking in places where it's not warranted, and fans really responded positively to that, certainly within the Vancouver market.
We're just moments away from Riley Shahan, who's going to be joining us today to talk a little bit about his season, which was remarkable. He got a late start, and then things really clicked in, and certainly was a big part of the penalty kill. And we're delighted to have Riley Shahan joining us here in a couple of minutes, John. But as we roll forward here over the next little while, we're going to talk more and more about this team and what they're going to be doing here in Edmonton. And I'm wondering, you know, if you're Ken Holland, you know, he's already brought back a lot of pieces. Do you bring back the entire penalty kill because they're so darn good, or do you believe maybe in the system a little more and not necessarily the specific players?
I think you have to give credit to both. I don't think there's much question that the coaches are doing a good job on the system, but at the same time, one of the things you see around the league is personnel does matter on the penalty kill. You want players who have done this before, players who have done it at a high level, and Edmonton went out and got those guys. I don't know that you need to have 100% retention of your penalty killers, but certainly you don't want to have massive turnover there if you can avoid it.
And that's a great opportunity for us to bring in Riley Shahan and talk to him a little bit. We welcome to the Oil Can Podcast, Riley Shahan. How are you, sir?
Great, thank you.
Are you continuing to I guess self isolate seems a little strong, but social distance? And how are you coming along with that? Is it a difficult adjustment for you, or are you hanging in there?
Yeah, it's definitely been a little weird, and I think everyone's in the same boat out there, so no feeling sorry for ourselves. But yeah, it's not being able to socialize and have face-to-face conversations with anyone has been a little tough, but we're managing and making the best of it.
Hey, Riley, John Willis here. I know one of the things that I've been trying to do is, you know, play card games over Zoom or whatever with my buddies. Are you keeping in touch with your friends in hockey in the same sort of way?
Yeah, I've gotten into that with some of my friends back home, and we're kind of all spread out, so it's nice to catch up. And I think this time just gives you that opportunity to reach out to people that maybe you haven't talked to in a while, and you sit here and you think about all the relationships you've had, and you can kind of catch up with some of those people. So in that way, it's been nice. And just played some video games with some of the guys on Edmonton, and try to keep in touch with them over the phone as much as I can.
Are you the best video game player on the team?
No, I'm terrible. I just enjoy the camaraderie there, and we play that Call of Duty game, so it gets your heart pumping a bit, and you can have some fun with it.
Are the young guys the best at it, or is it somebody we totally wouldn't expect?
Yeah, it's, I don't know, I haven't played with everybody, but I've heard some of our young guys are pretty good, and they stay up pretty late playing, and they're pretty dialed in. But yeah, I just play every once in a while with like Nuge and Benny, Nursey, and we have fun with it.
Nice. So one of the things, as we were talking about this beforehand, our producer, Jeff Demet, pointed out, is that you actually scored the last goal at Joe Louis Arena. You know, Henrik Zetterberg's 1,000th game, you come in with no goals, you score twice in that last game of the year. What was, I can't imagine what that must have been like for you.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Obviously, it's a special moment. I mean, that whole season was tough for me, and you go that long without scoring a goal, it wears on you, and you're pretty stressed. So I don't know what changed that last game. I just felt a little less stress, and just went out there and got the first one. And then the last one was kind of just a tapping on the doorstep there. So it was a fun game. And then obviously Z's last game, and you had all the Red Wing legends there to celebrate the arena. And it was a pretty cool night.
Riley, when you arrived here in Edmonton, you signed, as I recall, later on, maybe September, and still recovering from injuries. As I recall, you missed the first couple of games, and it took a little while for you to establish yourself. But my recollection is January. I might be wrong. You may remember a different time. But starting in January, I really felt, not just on the penalty kill, but at 5-on-5, things started to really click for you. Was that a matter of the getting over the injury and getting settled, or did it just take that much time to kind of get used to playing for the Oilers and in the system?
Yeah, it's hard to put a finger on it. I mean, you think about all the factors that go into changing teams and learning new systems and getting to know guys and things like that. I don't know if that was the reason or if things just started to click there. I think when I started playing with Archibald and Nygaard, we had some good chemistry there, and we kind of built off that. So yeah, you go through ups and downs throughout the season. Momentum's a crazy thing where if you can catch some momentum, catch some confidence and start rolling, then it's a lot easier to play the game.
I've talked a little bit to Archibald about this, but obviously you guys were aligned for most of the season, and then also the top penalty killing tandem on the team. Is it a situation where, like how much does personal chemistry play into it? Because I know you've penalty killed all over the league, but you and Archibald in particular working together seem to be, a really strong 4-on-5 tandem.
Yeah, for sure. I think chemistry is huge. I think being comfortable out there and knowing where your partner or your line mates are going to be and things like that, being able to communicate, it helps a ton. And I think just with Archie and I, we don't put any pressure on each other to make the right play all the time. We know we're going to screw up, and we just have to have each other's backs. And communication's huge on the penalty kill. If you can yell and talk and let a guy know he has time, or if there's a guy on him, things like that, I think it goes a long way. So I think in general, as a four-man unit, we do a good job at that.
You mentioned Nygaard. He got hurt, obviously, in the season, but he signed and he's coming back for next year. He adds, along with Archibald and yourself, that trio seemed to have some chemistry right from the get-go, because I think a lot of the elements that you have complement each other. Is that kind of chemistry that you had at the once you guys came together, does it take a little while to develop, or is there just sometimes when the chemistry is just naturally clicks right away?
Yeah, I think in that occasion it clicked pretty quickly, and I think in the NHL in general, there's a lot of line shuffling, and for us, I think to be able to spark like that, it helps, and you can get comfortable playing with each other. And yeah, you said it. I think we both kind of, or we, all three of us have things that we're strong at and things that we can complement each other at. So it worked out pretty well for us.
One of the things I was just looking over your career here, and it hadn't clicked with me for some reason, but you know, playing in Detroit, you played with Pavel Datsyuk and Henrik Zetterberg. Playing in Pittsburgh, you've played with Crosby and Malkin. And now playing in Edmonton, you've played with McDavid and Draisaitl. So I'm not going to ask you which of them's the best, because I don't think it's fair to throw that at you. But are there common things you've noticed between all those great centermen, and are there distinctions that sort of stand out to you?
Yeah, there's definitely there's similarities. I think obviously with Sid being one of the best players in the world for so long, and if not the best player, and then now you see Connor and Leon kind of stepping into that same sort of conversation, and there's definitely similarities in their work ethic and how they play on the ice when they turn it on and how much they can take over. I think it's pretty cool. And I think with Datsyuk and Zetterberg, for me personally, coming into the Red Wings organization as a young guy, and they were both so instrumental in showing me the ropes and just how hard it was to be an NHL player. But if you put in that work and you treat your teammates right and you treat the people around you right, I think it's a good recipe for success. So they all have different things that they're good at and different ways of playing, but there definitely is a commonality out there.
You signed late September and you know, came in and were immediately, the Oilers needed a player of your type, and there's no doubt about that. But it was a little later signing, obviously July versus when most happened, and you signed a little later. Is that sort of similar to your situation now in terms of not necessarily signing with the Oilers? We had heard there were some negotiations, but in terms of really not knowing where the season starts and or ends, we may get playoffs still. Is it sort of still up in the air, and does that remind you of a year ago?
Yeah, it definitely, it's not the ideal situation, but I know a lot of guys are going to be going through it, and it sucks that we're going to have back-to-back summers like this. And then on top of that, you don't know what's going to happen with the market and salary cap and things like that. But I mean, at the end of the day, we all get to play a game that we grew up loving and we love now for a living. And if I can be back in Edmonton, that'd be great. I've enjoyed my time there a ton, and I think we have a great team. And if the league continues, I think we have a great chance at doing something big. So, yeah, it is unfortunate. You like stability, and I think anybody likes stability, but we just kind of have to do the best we can to stay focused during this time.
Obviously, you've had moments of uncertainty over the course of your career. One of the things that I've kind of always been interested in is the way somebody, like, obviously you were a big star as a younger player, first round pick of the Red Wings, and a lot of guys drafted high sort of struggle with that adjustment from being, you know, the best player on their team all the time to being a role player at the professional level. And sadly, especially, you know, when you're in your early 20s, you kind of maybe are projected as still an offensive player. And in your case, you've settled into being a very solid checking center. What was that adjustment like for you? Is it the same game, or do you have to really dial in on certain aspects of the way you play?
Yeah, you definitely got to make adjustments. And I think those little things that go unnoticed are really important. And that's something I learned in Detroit. And I think if you're not going to be relied on to be a 1-2 or maybe top six guy, then you really got to focus in on those things like faceoffs and just little habits in the defensive zone and neutral zone to make sure you're not giving up many opportunities against. So yeah, it's hard, and sometimes it can be a tough pill to swallow, because I just, for me personally, I do know I still have a little bit of offensive touch in my game, and sometimes I have to kind of put that aside to worry about what's best for the team. So yeah, it's important, especially for young guys, to understand that and know that they should just be thriving for whatever position they're put in.
You know, Riley, you mentioned face-offs and 66 games. I know you had over 100 or 830 face-offs. It seemed like to me, you had a very good face-off percentage, even strength, but it seemed like to me you were taking a lot more face-offs, even to the point of taking a face-off and then heading to the bench. That has to give you an idea of how important that side of your game is to this specific team. Fair?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one thing I try to take pride in, and just those defensive zone starts and getting the puck out with possession. I think faceoffs are huge in that aspect. And I mean, for us, you'd rather not have Connor or Leon or one of those guys in our D zone kind of, I don't want to say wasting energy, but putting their energy into something where they could be using that for offensive opportunity or things like that. So yeah, it's something I take pride in, and I enjoy doing as well as a penalty kill. And I know if you're a bottom six guy on our team, you got to take pride in those situations, because they help our team win.
I'm so glad you mentioned defensive zone starts, because I always wonder how much players think about this stuff. Like I was looking at your career, and when you first broke into the league with Detroit, you know, 60-70% of the time you'd be starting in the offensive zone versus the defensive zone. And now you've got one of the toughest diets of zone starts in the league. Not counting the neutral zone, you're starting like 20-30% of your shifts in the offensive zone, and everything else is in your own end. Does that really become, you know, like, to what, obviously you're very aware of it, what's the key to being relied upon in the defensive zone, and like what makes you able to do that?
I think just little decisions that you make when it comes to stopping underneath the puck and making sure you're staying on your man and reading the play properly. I mean, leaning towards the defensive side rather than the offensive side. So I think for us, just being able to break out clearly or clean and go down into the offensive zone and generate a little bit of time there and maybe force the team into icing the puck or the goalie into covering the puck. And then we can bring out our big guns who can try to capitalize on some offensive time. I think things like that kind of go a long way. And if you can do that over and over and over again and wear a team down, then I think that's a good recipe for success.
Raleigh, two areas that you did very well at 5-on-5 this past year, and Oiler fans being aware of it because of the third and fourth lines a year ago in 18-19 didn't have a lot of offense, but you rated very high in turnovers. You took a lot of pucks away from opponents and in individual high danger scoring chances. And I always wonder when those two things mesh, it tells me that there's a lot of back checking and maybe a lot of offense that comes off the rush or broken plays from the opposition. Is that how you perceive a lot of your offense coming about?
Yeah, we like to, I think, or I guess whatever line I'm on, if I'm with Archie and Nye, we focus on our forecheck a lot. And I mean, our possession sometimes isn't as great as our top two lines, but we work on putting the puck into good areas where we can get it back and kind of grinding a bit. So I think a lot of those turnovers come from good positioning and just being aware of where we are on the ice and trying to get our defensemen in the zone and covering for them too. So yeah, not necessarily cycling around like our top two lines, but just trying to get in on the forecheck and get some sticks and get our stick on the puck and then go from there.
Those are tough specialized minutes you're playing. I know in talking to Dave Tippett at some points there's been a mention that maybe there's an element of fatigue because you guys are killing penalties, especially when the schedule gets compressed. With that in mind, how do you feel about, like, there's lots of different scenarios that have been tossed about how the NHL could go going forward and maybe even compressing next season. Do you think that, you know, it's going to be very difficult to compress the year just because guys are going to get hurt? It's going to increase the risk of injury?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, obviously we want to play for our fans and we want to get a full season in, and schedule is already tough as it is, so yeah, it's tough to think about compressing it. But I mean, right now I think you have so many different resources to take care of your body, and whether it's hands-on treatment, cold tubs, hot tubs, I think the training formula has changed a lot compared to the past, where you're not putting as much weight on your back and taxing your body as much in that aspect. So there could be ways around it. I mean, I don't want to be the one making those decisions because I feel like whoever is going to get some tough feedback. But we also got to put it in a bigger picture and know we're playing this game for a lot of people who love watching us and love putting money into the game. So we got to factor that in too.
Roddy, when I talk to fans, it's almost evenly split. There are a group who go, look, this season is done. Don't even, you know, play the playoffs. And then there's another group who are, man, I don't care if we're watching the Stanley Cup Finals in September. you know, all this work happened. I want to see a Stanley Cup, you know, over, you know, Bettman's got to hand it to somebody. So, and I know it's, you probably feel some ways in both sides, but is there a general feeling for you and for the players that you want to get back at it, or would it just feel too weird to have a training camp in August and then play for the Stanley in September?
Yeah, it's definitely weird to think about. But at the same time, yeah, you'd like to see a winner. And just speaking as an Oiler, I mean, you put in the work to put yourself in a playoff position. I know there's been a couple-year drought, and our fans are so passionate, and they want to see us in the playoffs, so we want to play for them. And at the same time, though, you don't want to be getting big crowds together in a time when this virus is so threatening, and obviously, we don't want to put anyone's safety in harm's way, but it's a tough situation. And I mean, I'd like to see a team win, and I'd like to have that chance of doing so.
Before we went on the air here, our colleague Daniel Nugent-Bowman mentioned that you got engaged late last summer. Have you had your plans been forced to change by everything that's going on?
No, thank God. We decided to wait just because the chaotic summer of signing and then the quick move into Edmonton. We figured that waiting two summers would be the smart move. So, I couldn't imagine having to replan all that. And I feel sorry for any of those couples that are getting or are supposed to get married this summer.
Is it harder to face off against Anze Kopitar or plan a wedding?
I mean, I'm doing all the work and the face off against Kopitar, and my fiance does most of the work for this wedding planning, so I just give her the okay, and usually I'm satisfied with whatever she decides. So I'd say taking the face off.
Okay.
since Al's brought it up, is there somebody in particular that you line up in the face off circle and you're like, oh man, this is going to be rough?
It's tough. I mean, obviously, like, Bergeron's really good. I enjoy facing off against him because it's a challenge. And I actually think this year I didn't do too bad against him. I actually struggle this year with Jamie Benn. He's really strong. And it was just the one game I struggled with him pretty hard. So I don't know. It just depends on the game. I think sometimes you get into a rhythm and you feel like you can't lose. And then other games, it's the opposite, where you just feel like whatever you do, you're not going to win. So it's just depending on the game.
It's such a very specific thing. I've read on face-offs and the importance of face-offs, and some people think it's not that big a deal, but a lot happens within like 4 or 5 seconds after a face-off if you lose it, and it is vital. And my question to you is always, and I don't have the answer, so I'm looking forward to yours. Strong side to weak side, how difficult is it to win a weak side face-off for you, for anybody?
I think it's tough. I think any guy who can find a strategy to win consistently on their weak side has got a definite advantage, especially now with the rules, with the icing calls and the power play and getting to pick which dot you go to. You have to have a way of winning it on your weak side. But yeah, it's tough because normally you're going against a guy's powerful side, and it's sometimes it just comes to bearing down a bit on your stick and trying to just fall on the puck and creating a scramble, or just being a little quicker. And it all just depends on who your opponent is. But yeah, I think faceoffs are huge. It's a possession game now, and it all starts off a clean win. So they're really important.
You mentioned Ben's strength in the faceoff circle. Obviously, you're a bigger player yourself. Size or speed, which is more important, or are they sort of evenly in terms of winning draws?
Yeah, I guess it just depends on how well you can do them. You look at the way Sid takes faceoffs, and it's all speed, and his stick is just unbelievable, and he does really well at that. And then yeah, you go the other way, and you look at a guy like Ben. Even Bergeron, he gets real low, and he grips his stick tight and tries to snap it back. O'Reilly, the same. I have a tough time with O'Reilly because he's got a good technique. So, yeah, just whatever you do, if you're good at it, it's tough to defend against. And I'd much rather go against a guy trying to win for speed than a guy who's just kind of putting all of his strength down on his bottom hand and trying to snap it back.
Do you ever watch old timey face-offs like from 100 years ago and go, man, they didn't even try, right? Like, it seems like the styles are different. I remember Boyd Gordon used to try to dig a ditch when he did the face-off, and I thought that was the best plan, but then they made it illegal. Is there somebody from your past that you model on, or that you have you followed or paid attention to face-off, I guess, strategy over the years?
Yeah, I remember growing up, and this is before I really even was thinking that hockey could be a future for me, but I remember watching Yannick Perreau when he was playing for the Leafs, and I always remember hearing how good he was at faceoffs, and I guess he had a pretty big blade, which was kind of early. I think now a lot more guys are focusing on those things for for the face-off advantage. And then I went out with Zenon Konopka one time on the ice just strictly to learn face-off, because he was actually really, really good at it too. But he did the same thing. He'd tie up a guy's stick and then sweep the puck back with his hand. So that got taken out of the game, and now is a penalty. But yeah, he taught me actually a few things that stuck with me, and just trying to take over 50% of the dot and things like that. And yeah, there's a lot of hidden techniques that people don't really think of, but there's a lot that goes into taking a faceoff.
Riley Shahan, this has been a delight. I really appreciate it. We covered a lot of ground, and you were a great interview. I thank you.
All right, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks again.
That was fantastic, Riley. Thanks for doing this, really, and thanks for going into the minutia with us.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Riley Shahan, our guest on the Oil Can Podcast. John, that was, I always say this, but I think of the interviews we've done, I think that's either the or one of the best. A very thoughtful guy.
That was fantastic. The thing is, all of these guys know so much about the game, and the question is the degree to whether to which they're willing to open the door and talk it out with you. And he was just so generous with his answers and his thoughts there on the game. I love that he mentioned Zenon Konopka, because that's a guy I remember. As soon as he said it, I was like, yes, I remember him being just a beast in the faceoff circle.
It was very informative, and we got into a lot of different areas: penalty kills and power plays. By the way, I should ask you, John. Are you able to stay sane, or are you finding it difficult to be isolated in a way and still working at the level that you are, coming up with new ideas? Because I'll tell you, coming up with new ideas is a real challenge right now.
It is, but I had the fortune or misfortune of covering the league during the 2013 lockout, and I've also been, because I was a freelancer for so many years, I'm used to trying to generate ideas in the summer. So right now I'm actually, you know, I wish I wasn't stuck at home, you know, isolated, but I'm very thankful for the opportunity to get to work on some bigger projects that honestly, during the day-to-day of the season, I just don't have time to get to.
I don't know how long, and I hate to keep coming back to this, but it's fresh because it's just out this week. How long did it take you to pull all the pieces together for the article about the NHL broadcast?
Well, it's funny because we had somebody say, you know, oh, this is the kind of content I'm so glad to see, and you might not have got to do otherwise. But this was actually in the book since October, and the reason for that is, well, initially I'd planned to rate them myself, and then of course it switched to a survey mode. But either way, either approach, I needed to watch enough of each broadcast that I wasn't flying blind. And between doing my day-to-day job and trying to watch out-of-market coverage, I made it a goal to watch two of each broadcast. It was a mountain of work, and it needed a long run. And I'm just glad the survey results came in, because it was a much, much better piece than it would have been if it had been just my opinion.
You know, and it's funny because it did resonate. I can tell you a lot of people that I know in the industry, the broadcast industry, were very curious about it. And there was some criticisms and obviously a lot of positives. But I felt overall that you handled it fairly. And the reaction that I've gotten from the people I spoke to in the industry was that they also felt that way, that it was a respectful piece. Have you gotten a similar reaction?
I've heard a lot from people within the industry. Interestingly, I had one of the play-by-play guys who was sort of middle of the pack reach out to ask if he could see some of the survey data just as a self-improvement exercise, so he could see what people were thinking. It's been good. I really tried to be fair, because the thing that I went into it thinking was that, you know, like I've said elsewhere, I'd get eaten alive in these roles. These are very difficult jobs. It's really easy to be critical, and I don't begrudge fans for being critical, because they deserve a good call. They deserve a good product, and by all means, there's a lot of pressure on these positions. But I try not to lose sight of the fact that they're very difficult, and everybody's trying to do the best they can in the various roles.
Want to remind you that Dallas Eakins, head coach of the Anaheim Ducks, will join Shane O'Brien and Josh Cooper on Point Breakaway. And don't forget to please rate and subscribe the Oil Can on Apple. If you click on the show URL at theathletic.com/theoilcan, you'll get 40% off your subscription to The Athletic. On behalf of Jonathan Willis, I'm Alan Mitchell. Thank you for tuning into the Oil Can Podcast.